The Tom Woods Show, episode 1931.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, joined today by Germinal G. Van. And I'm not going to tell you how old this guy is. I'm just going to say he's awfully young to have written 19 books already. I don't know how that's possible. But we're talking today in particular about his book, The Economic Condition of Black America in the 20th Century, A Historical and Empirical Analysis. Germinal, welcome to the show.
Oh my God, thank you so much, Tom. I'm glad to be on your platform. It's a dream coming true. Thank you.
That's very kind of you to say. Well, you are one of the few people in this little ideological world of ours who makes me feel like a lazy bum when I look at your productivity. You're only 31 years old. You're a pup, for heaven's sake. So I don't know how you're doing it. But I want to start up before we get into the topic of your book. You, I guess, came to the United States in 2010. I read that somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you came from what English speakers sometimes call the Ivory Coast or Côte d'Ivoire.
Yes.
And I'm interested in what that was like, or what made you decide to move to the U.S., first of all?
Yeah, sure. So for some reason, I always loved Anglo-Saxon culture. And since I was age 10, I always wanted to come to the U.S. I even told my mom that one day I would come to the United States. I remember it was in 2000 because I was 10 years old. And one of the conditions for me to come, my parents said that, okay, if you succeed in the baccalaureate, which is the high school diploma exam that everyone has to take in Ivory Coast, then I can pursue my studies in the United States. So I took it the first year and I failed miserably. And I took it the second year. I changed my major and stuff. I took it the second year and I succeed. So that's when I was able to come to the U.S. with a student visa at the Catholic University of America. That's where I studied political science and I minored in philosophy.
Let's ask you a quick question about the Ivory Coast itself. I don't know much history about it.
Yeah.
But this president, Houphouet Boigny, mm-hmm. would you say that he was more good guy than bad guy? How do you assess him?
So everything depends on the angle that we are evaluating him. So Houphouet Boigny was known to be a good Ivorian, but a bad African. So the reason why is that is because Houphouet Boigny developed Ivory Coast significantly under his rule. He ruled for like 33 years. He developed the country, and basically the country was the most advanced among all the other countries in West Africa. But he was considered a bad African because he was, instead of standing against the West, he was working with the West, specifically the French, while people like Lumumba, Kwame Nkrumah, all these Pan-Africanist leaders stood against Europeans. Houphouet Boigny did not mind having Europeans assisting us. In fact, he understood that, and that's why I agree with him. He understood that after the colonization, we had basically nothing to develop ourselves. So he knew that it would be better to associate ourselves with the former colony and take advantage of what we have until we're able to reach a full political maturity and go on our own. That's what he did. But people did not understand his vision, I think.
Well, I can understand that because at the time, he and maybe one other person really stood out in not taking that kind of pan-African view. Now, nothing wrong with having a pan-African view,
yeah,
as long as it's not driven by socialism and chauvinism. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But he said once, I recall, he was, I guess, speaking to the Organization of African Unity.
Yes.
And he said, I know a lot of you are, you know, pushing the Europeans out of your country. He says, well, in Ivory Coast, I've got 40,000 Frenchmen, and I'm going in a different direction. And in fact, I hope things will change. I hope eventually there'll be 100,000 Frenchmen, And then several years from now, we can meet again and compare the progress we've been making. He said, but unfortunately, gentlemen, I suspect many of you will not be in a position to attend. So he was not shy about making his opinions known.
Oh, no, he was not at all. He was a visionary, in my opinion. He's someone who knew and understood. Unfortunately, he couldn't live forever. So after his death, that's when the country got into an everlasting political crisis.
Have you traveled much throughout Africa? I know, we have to get to your book eventually, but
oh, no.
I'm just, yeah. Before coming to the U.S., did you do much traveling?
Yeah, actually, I lived in Kenya for 4 years. That's where I learned English for the very first time. I lived in Kenya, so in Nairobi from 2001 to 2005, and it was very, very difficult. You know, you come to a new country, you don't know the language, and you're like, what am I doing here? And I was in boarding school with my sister. So it was very difficult. It was difficult times. But, you know, difficult times makes you stronger and you learn and you become more independent as you grow. So I lived in Kenya for 4 years. I also traveled to Rwanda, Tanzania, because my dad used to work at the United Nations. He used to be a prosecutor for the Rwanda genocide. So,
fascinating.
Yeah. So I was able to travel for a little bit on the continent. I've been to Ethiopia as well. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. These are the main countries on the continent I've been to.
But you were traveling. If you came to the U.S. in 2010, you were 20 years old.
Yes.
You were doing this traveling as a young man. Mm-hmm. Were you still, even though you were a young man, were you still able to make observations of the different countries that, like mature observations where you would say, maybe this political system works better than that one, that kind of thing?
So at that time, I would say that my observations were not that deep yet, but I could already see some differences. And one of the differences was that when you look at the form of colonizations, right, you look at the French and you look at the British, when you live in an English-speaking country, people don't really care about your origins. What they care about is what you bring economically to the table. How do you contribute to the economic development of the country? And it's interesting because the British never tried to change the indigenous people. But the French, on the other hand, always wanted to do that. The people they colonized, they wanted to turn them into French people. And they completely forgot that we have our own cultures, our own values. So we can speak French, but we will never be French. And that's the thing. And that's one of the reasons why French-speaking countries are lagging compared to English-speaking countries. And that was one of the first things that I understood from the get-go.
Wow, that is interesting. Now, have you been back since you moved to the U.S.?
Yeah, so the first time I went back was basically in 2011. I went back to see my mom, and then I went back in 2012, then in 2013, and in 2015. So 2015 was the very last time I went back home.
Is there anything about it that you miss? Obviously, you preferred to go abroad, but is there anything about it where you say, well, there really is something about this that really is home for me?
I mean, I would say the food. The food is one. The humor is another one.
The humor? How is the humor different?
I mean, Ivorian humor is, it's not even French humor. I mean, French humor, like, it's, people don't know that French people are, excuse my language, jackass.
Okay.
But Ivorian humor, like, it's very different in the sense that you need to have a thick skin to handle it.
Oh.
If you don't have thick skin, yeah, you will take things very personal, and it's not. People tease a lot, and for someone who doesn't have a thick skin, he might take it the wrong way, and it's not that we're seeking deliberately to verbally harm someone. Of course not. It's just that it's just the way we tease, the way we joke around.
This is going to be the last thing I ask about Ivory Coast, but how does it rank roughly in terms of prosperity among the various African countries?
Yes. Yeah, so I was checking this morning the data for the Economic Freedom Index, and I think Ivory Coast is among the mostly free countries. I think it's ranked 64, 65, or maybe in the 70s. I'm not too sure, but I know it is in the mostly free countries. So that is to tell you that Ivory Coast is one of the countries that is safe when it comes to do business, because Oufouet-Boigny implemented that culture of entrepreneurship back home. So investors from all around the world come to Ivory Coast to invest. That is why we have been prosperous for a very long time. We've always focused on increasing our property rights index too, because we know that if you have a country where the property rights are enforced, you feel safe investing there because you know that you have a return on your investment. So this is basically what Ivory Coast has been focusing on, and we are among the first in West Africa. I mean, of course, Nigeria and Ghana right now are thriving, but when it comes to the French-speaking countries, we're definitely the first.
Okay. All right. Very good. That's more or less what I thought from the reading that I have done on the subject. Now, let's get to your, when I say your book, I just mean the book we're talking about today. I don't mean to imply that you have only one book, because you have 19 of them somehow at age 31. Anyway, so we're talking about the economic condition of Black America in the 20th century. Now, you could write a book like this and just have a lot of facts and figures, but then that wouldn't be very interesting to people. There's always got to be some underlying thesis. So why did you write this book? What were you trying to bring to light by tracing out the economic history of Black Americans in the 20th century?
So first of all, Black Americans are Africans like me. Like, they are my brothers, if we want to call it by race, by civilization. But I was always wondering why Black Americans are so backwards when it comes to economic and social development compared to the other communities in the U.S. Because someone like me, for instance, I came here in 2010 and I behaved pretty well and I was able to escape poverty. I mean, I have to admit that I could have done stuff that would have made me basically doomed to be in poverty, but I didn't. And it was really shocking to me to see that you had people here in the U.S. who were born and have access to opportunities and resources, and they're lagging. I couldn't understand it. Because me, for instance, like, if I didn't have my parents to help me pay my studies, I couldn't take loans from the government, for instance. I mean, thank God I didn't take loans anyways. But at the time, I didn't understand how the loans work and stuff. And I was willing to actually take it and pursue my education. But in the U.S., you have Black Americans who have access to education and they can't make it. So that was one factor. The other factor was even the living conditions. And they've been using slavery as the common denominator to justify why they've been lagging economically and socially. So I wanted to make an inquiry and go all the way to the 19th century to understand, because that's when slavery was legal, then it got abolished. So from the time it got abolished to the 21st century, what Black people have been through to be where they are today. And in my research, I realized that Black people have done a lot of progress. And what is shocking about that is that the progress they made it through themselves without government help. Whenever the government tried to help them, it actually made them backwards. Like, it prevented them from moving forward. I mean, we can go deeper into that. Like, when we look at the welfare state, for instance, that is a perfect example where Black people have been lagging since this program has been implemented in America. Black people have not thrived the way they should have been. Those who have thrived are those who relied on the market means to reach their end.
Okay. So that's more or less the thesis that I identified in the book, and I assumed you were going to be pursuing before I even looked at it. So let's start with the very beginning of the 20th century. And again, there's so much to talk about. I might have to actually have you back a second time to really get through all of it. But you say right at the beginning that when you're talking about the early part of the 20th century, you say that this section of your book attempts to synthesize how the African-American community has managed to use market-based solutions to advance its condition while being persecuted by state governments, especially in southern states. So let's talk about that. Describe for me exactly what was happening at the first couple of decades of the 20th century. As obviously, there's really no welfare state to speak of in the U.S. I mean, there are little widows programs here and there, but nothing like what exists now. So you almost had to pursue a market-based approach because there's nobody who's going to help you.
Exactly. So when you look at specifically in the South, at the beginning of the 20th century, you see that Southern government implemented a set of laws to basically maintain Black people as second-class citizens. And what Black people understood was that specifically Booker T. Washington, he explained that for Black people to be respected and to be viewed as the equal of the white man, they have to focus on their education and their skills. It's true, at the time, Black and whites could not go to the same school, but they have HBCUs. So for the Blacks who were able to go to the HBCU, so those who were able to read, write, and count, so who have access to education, they should have focused and go all the way to, let's say, the doctorate, because that would guarantee them a path to a sustainable life and to make a living for themselves. And for those who were not able to read, write, and count, they could nonetheless go to trade school. That's what Booker T. Washington advocated in his book, Out from Slavery. They could go to trade school and learn a skill that would make them useful and indispensable in society. So that's how Black people started to organize, and they were able to create the Black Wall Street. But of course, at the time, white Southerners saw that, okay, these Blacks are becoming an economic threat to us. They're creating their own banks, they're creating their own businesses. They're basically taking over, so we have to stop them. So that's how, unfortunately, the destruction of Black Wall Street happened. But Black people focused a lot on creating businesses that they knew that they could provide goods and services for the community and that will gather them together. And what is interesting is that when they were creating those businesses, that did not bother the whites that were not really into the racial bias or anything. Because as Thomas Sowell said, the color of the market is green. The racist guy is not going to say, if he needs to make money, he's not going to say, oh, I'm only selling for white people. If a Black person comes in to buy his product, he's still going to take the Black person's money. And that was the same philosophy that Blacks were applying for themselves. And that's why they were able to make significant progress, even at that period in history already, before Jim Crow became like, you know, took another dimension. So you had whites that were purchasing Black people's product, Black people's services, and that helped Black people making money in the community.
Do you think there's something we should say about a contemporary of Booker T. Washington, and that is W.E.B. Du Bois, who, by the way, just for anybody listening, that is how he pronounced his name. He pronounced it Du Bois. And the question is, it's been a perennial one throughout the history of Blacks in America about the relative importance of political action to economic success. And I can see both sides of the argument, even in what you've just said, that on the one hand, Booker T. Washington is obviously giving good advice to people, because maybe who knows when political progress will occur. You have to do something now. You might as well build up your skills, provide something that is valuable to other people. And even if white people are making your life difficult, you can always sell to other Black people. As you say, you can sell people in the community. But given that they did operate under certain disabilities, doesn't that vindicate the Du Bois approach of political action?
So yes and no. Yes, because it vindicated Du Bois, because Du Bois argued that capitalism was not made for Black people, that Black people had trouble thriving under capitalism because you have a government with institutions that only implement laws that will facilitate access to property. Or to property for white people, but not for Black people. So yeah, that vindicated Du Bois, because like when you look at the redlining policies, it backs Du Bois' argument that you have, unfortunately, a biased government that would favor one community over the other. But at the same time too, the problem with Du Bois, and my personal issue with Du Bois, is that Du Bois, instead of having more and more of a positive approach to how to uplift Black people, he was making them feel like they were doomed. And I understand why he did that. It's for Black people to understand their conditions. But when you try to make people aware of their condition by making them feel like they're doomed, all they're going to do is to feel like they're victims. And the victimhood mentality that we have today in America is the ideological residue of Du Bois. Mm. And that bothers me.
But yet, if you go to any African-American studies department in America, and you say that, you would, let's say, not be greeted with open arms as someone who's going to bring an interesting new perspective. It's everybody thinks one particular way, almost everybody thinks one particular way, and not just in that department, on the whole campus. Booker T. Washington is thought of as a sellout who wouldn't stand up for his own race. You can't even have a conversation about it.
Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, that's one of the big issue with the African-American communities, that if you think like Booker T. Washington, as you say, you're a sellout, you're not black. As if there is a way to measure blackness. Basically, you have to think a certain way. You have to be progressive, left-wing. If you think for yourself, if you think that you can make things on your own, you can lift yourself, you have a problem. You hang out with too many white people. No, I'm a human being. Like, I didn't choose my skin color. Okay, I was born as a human being who happens to be Ivorian, who happens to speak French. And that's it. I didn't choose my parents. I didn't choose my nationality. I didn't choose the language I speak. But what I know is my education. I know that by being educated, by having the skills I need to prosper in society, and by behaving correctly, I can have a secured life and provide for my family. That's what I understood. And I didn't think that the system was oppressing me. And I wrote this book, in fact, for Black people to understand that it's through the market that you thrive. In fact, the system that you're asking to giving you handouts is that very same system who has been maintaining you in that mental slavery after actual slavery.
Folks, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BetterHelp. We're halfway through the year now. So if you didn't keep any of those New Year's resolutions, maybe it's time to make some resolutions for the second half of the year. And perhaps one of those resolutions can be to take on whatever it is that's holding you back from happiness. I'm going to be completely honest with you guys. I've used BetterHelp myself. They match you up with a licensed professional therapist who can help you with anything from depression or stress or anxiety to relationships, trauma, sleeping, anger, family conflicts, and more. It's super convenient, entirely confidential, affordable. You run it from your computer. You can communicate with your counselor through messages anytime. And then you can set up weekly telephone or video sessions. You don't have to be in the United States to use BetterHelp. The service is available worldwide. Check out the testimonials they post daily on their site to see for yourself. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/woods. Let's move ahead a little bit now in time and go up to the Great Depression. We'll skip over the 20s. Maybe you can tell us in brief how the prosperity of the 20s extended to Black Americans. And then let's talk about the period of the Depression and the New Deal, because here there's some material I think a lot of people aren't aware of, that some people referred to the NRA program, the National Recovery Administration, as the Negro Removal Act because of the effects that it had. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of unknown history in this period of time. But so starting in the 1920s, let's just say, did Black Americans share in the general prosperity of the time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they did pretty well. In fact, the incomes increased, the number of entrepreneurs increased, and the number of businesses that were created increased. I mean, beside the destruction of Black Wall Street, Black businesses around the country increased. Why? Because of the Great Migration. People were being tired of being oppressed in the South. First of all, they're being oppressed. The South is broke. They don't produce any money, no wealth, nothing. So people say, we're going to move to the most industrialized places. Of course, it doesn't mean that in the North or the East or maybe the West, people were holy. Of course not. People had their racial biases, but people were willing to hire Blacks because they need labor. And Blacks were also willing to work for lower wages so long as they can put food on the table and provide for their families. So that's why Black people were able to participate in the boom and actually take profit from that economic boom in the 20s. And then the Great Depression happened, and we have those on the left blaming capitalism for the failure, but we all know that it was, in fact, the Federal Reserve that messed up. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. That's why we had the Great Depression. And FDR policies did not favor Blacks, in fact. That's the funny part. Like, all the policies he implemented, there was a policy that he implemented for agriculture. Basically, white people had to give their dead land to Blacks. but those lands, you cannot do anything with it. And that was a law, like specifically in the Southern state. And FDR did that to maintain the Southern vote, something that people don't really know about it. Because the welfare system started under FDR, but the policies of the welfare state at the time were only for whites. Blacks did not even have access to welfare policies until LBJ. So most of FDR policies did not benefit Black at all. Blacks just became more Democrats because of Herbert Hoover, who was a huge interventionist. Most of the policies that he implemented alienated Blacks, and it made it worse for Blacks to move forward. That's why they start voting massively, of course, under the leadership of Du Bois, for Democrats and FDR. But the policies of FDR did not improve Black people's condition, at least not significantly. It may have helped some of them, but the majority did not benefit from it.
Now, that comes as a big surprise to most people because a lot of people have a frankly cartoonish view of American history, where there are some people who want to help the less fortunate and others who don't. And we know who's who. We know that Franklin Roosevelt must have been one of those people because, well, it says so in my book. But the reality was a little bit more complicated than that, as some of us have tried to show. Now let's talk about somebody else who is assumed to have had good motives and wanted to help people, and that is Lyndon Johnson. You made reference to him before. And the growth of the welfare state under the War on Poverty and Great Society. Mm-hmm. Now, that does not seem to be a bad thing to the average person. It seems like Johnson wanted to lift a lot of people out of poverty, so he was going to do it through these various transfer programs. How could that possibly turn into a bad thing?
Well, so LBJ had a genuine thought for Blacks because he grew up poor. I mean, not completely poor. His dad was a politician too, but he grew up in poverty to some extent, so he understood. But at the same time, his choices were calculated because, as we all know, he wanted to make sure that the black vote would be secure for a long period of time in the Democratic Party. But what people did not understand is that what happened was a social contract, right? The Civil Rights Act and the welfare state was a social contract. What that social contract was about. It was an Hobbesian social contract. It was the Leviathan. I'm giving you a set of positive rights. Positive rights are rights that once you're granted to it, the sovereign can take it away from you. So the Democratic Party, through Lyndon Johnson's presidency, granted a set of rights to Black people. And in exchange, for Black people, part of the contract is to keep voting Democrats for every election cycle to come. And then they say, we're going to give you free housing, free food. We're going to basically pay for your reparations in terms of kind. So through a welfare state, so you have access to shelter and all this. So that's what happened. And in exchange for that, you will think and vote Democrat for the next century or two to come. And that was the theory I developed in that part of the book, is to explain that Hobbesian social contract theory, that it wasn't a negative right contract where, okay, it's my God-given right. No, it was the government giving you a set of rights. And whatever government gives you, we all know that it can take it away from you at any time. So that's what happened with LBJ. And people don't realize that these programs are not meant to help you thrive. They're basically meant to help you stay alive. And if you barely stay alive, there's nothing much you can do to enjoy yourself as a human being in a free society.
So what do you think happens then to somebody who is on the receiving end of these programs? I mean, surely some people use the programs and are able to get over a difficult part in their lives and then carry on and become successful. But on the other hand, it seems like that's not really the norm. Now, why would that be? What exactly are these programs doing to people?
Well, these programs simply create the incentive to not leave poverty. Because with this program, and this is not just in the United States, this is the welfare mentality in the world, is that you're under welfare because you don't make money. So the minute you have a job and that job you got makes you more than what the welfare state gives you, you're off welfare. Because with welfare is that you're making money for not working. So you have people staying at home, receiving their cut every 2 weeks or every month. It depends on how the payments are set, but they're receiving their cut. So when you are making money without having to spend any physical effort, without having to wake up in the morning, commuting, going to the office and finishing at 10 p.m. and then you have to commute back again, all of that, people see, what should I work for? So this program simply creates incentive of staying in poverty. It creates incentive of bad behavior. There was a study that showed that the government was basically incentivizing women to have, specifically Black women, to have kids with different men so that they can collect welfare paychecks. And on the other hand, the Black man is going to prison so that his girl can have the paychecks. Otherwise, if they're married, they don't get any benefits. So that's how, if you see, the welfare state basically destroyed the Black family unit. Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams conducted a study where they saw that before the welfare state, the Black family unit was actually stronger. Unemployment in the Black youth was lower. Before the welfare state, it was at 10 or 15%. But after the welfare state, unemployment in the Black youth completely increased. Single parents household also increased the rate. It was 22% before the welfare state. After the welfare state, it reached 73%. So this tells you how the welfare state, instead of improving the life and well-being of Black people, it just destroyed. It did the opposite, completely destroyed the well-being. And today, that's why you see the project. You cannot live there. You cannot even go there because it's unbearable. Because all these people do every day is to stay home and do all kind of stuff and be unproductive and waiting for their welfare paychecks.
Well, you said that, not me.
Yeah, I said that.
I'm just saying, I mean, honestly, your career would be ruined if you said something like that.
Oh, no.
Career would be, wouldn't matter whether it was accurate or not, does not matter. Let me raise two historical items that I'd like you to comment on. The first is the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the second is the War on Drugs. Mm-hmm. Those are huge topics. So tell me first, let's do one at a time. Civil Rights Act of 1964 has a variety of different features in it, mm-hmm. having to do with public accommodations and non-discrimination in public accommodations, mm-hmm. but also it has to do with discrimination in private employment. So there are two features to it. What do you think about it? I mean, is it, do you attribute Black economic advancement to the Civil Rights Act of 1964?
I mean, I cannot totally discredit the Civil Rights Act of 1964 because it did contribute to the advancement to some extent, but the magnitude is not significant because with those laws, in fact, is that like what those laws generate was for recent affirmative actions. In my opinion, it made it Black people more entitled and feeling less responsible for their actions, in my opinion. Yes, they have the right to vote. They have like access to public resources and stuff, which is definitely a step forward. But for instance, like you have Blacks applying for schools and they would get picked at the school, especially, let's say specifically a very good school. They would get picked at the school, not because of their grades or anything, but because of their skin color to fill a quota. Again, Thomas Sowell made a study on that when he was talking about a mismatch. And it's the same with employment too, because they're compelling, because the civil rights act compel employers to hire people, not necessarily based on their skills and competence, but based on their skin color to diversify the body. That could lead to inefficiencies. That could lead to inefficiencies too. I'm not saying that it's something that has happened nationwide, but it has that effect on some parts. Like I know, for instance, when I was working as a paralegal before, there was one person that had a long, long experience as a legal assistant. And she was telling me that in the 70s and 80s, like her employer had to hire people not based on what they were, but because they had to fill a quota, and that it basically reduced the output of the firm. So that is like one observation that I was told of, and I could see that. So to me, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it's a mixed feeling. It had some positive and some negative effect, but I can say that Black people lost more of their economic rights and gained more in their political rights because it made people more dependent on the welfare state. The welfare state grew after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed in Congress.
Well, now, the second thing I want to know, again, in connection with the economic position of Black people, because that is the subject of your book, how does the war on drugs factor into that story?
Well, the war on drugs was a way to maintain Blacks as second-class citizens. And when you're able to lock up someone, after that person has done its time in prison, that person now comes into a social prison. That person cannot rent an apartment or any type of real estate. That person cannot even apply for a job. So basically, that person is doomed. Unless that person knows a friend who owns a small business, he can work and get paid under the table, it's going to be hard for that person to get back into the corporate world and make a living. So by implementing laws that would make it easier to arrest Blacks, it impact the income of Blacks because more Blacks were interned in the prisons. So as they intern in the prisons, there's no income to be made in the prisons. And that definitely affect the way the kids of those people who are going to prison can even go to school and have a father at home that will check on them and follow their education. So the war on drugs, on top of that, what it did was to racialize poverty. It racialized poverty by saying that basically the people, Black people are the poor ones. So they're the poor ones making always the same mistake, creating the same troubles we have in society. So to get rid of the trouble, we're going to have to lock them up and let the white middle class suburban family safe. And that was at the same time, too, you see the redlining policies where people start shifting, where more Blacks start living in the inner cities and more whites start living in the suburbs in the late 1960s, early 1970s, specifically under the presidency of Nixon. That's when that migration, I would call that, and that internal migration started to happen across various cities in the U.S.
Well, what is it that changed between Nixon and then we get to Clinton that you would refer in your book to the crime of Bill Clinton involving mass incarceration? How did we go from just the war on drugs to the mass incarceration? What's the difference between one and the other?
So the difference was that Nixon was basically focusing on hard drugs, whereas Bill Clinton was focusing on all type of drugs, and not just drugs, but all type of crimes too. So what has happened was that under Bill Clinton, though, crime did significantly decrease, but at the expense of destroying Black families too. Because Bill Clinton created that three-strike rule. After three strikes, you're out. And what he did was that his presidency created a deal with private prisons too, where people had to serve a certain time in order to be able to get parole. And then they give money to those prisons to maintain the inmates, specifically Black and Hispanic inmates, longer in prison. So I can't remember exactly. I don't have the book with me, but I know that in the chapter for sure, they created that law, and it was Joe Biden who actually drafted in the three-strike rule, where people, specifically Black and Hispanics, will be maintained longer in the prisons because they're the one that committed the most crimes when it comes to all type of drugs and crime in general in the inner cities, because they're the one living more in the inner cities than whites. Whites were mainly populated in the suburbs.
There's so many more things I want to ask, but I've got to kind of keep to the usual show schedule. So I'd like to get you back on because I have a lot of other things I want. I've wanted to spend the whole episode really on your background because I'm curious how you wind up in, if you're raised in a French-speaking country, or at least a country that had been colonized by France, mm-hmm. how could it be that you would suddenly have an interest in Anglo-Saxon? I'm going to ask you. What the heck? As long as I'm saying the question, why don't I ask it to you? How did you become interested in Anglo-Saxon culture?
Well, I've been a very pragmatic person. I'm someone who knows how to sense opportunities. And this is something I learned from, first of all, from reading books about the English-speaking countries, the Anglo-Saxon culture, is that Anglo-Saxon people, they are basically merchants. This is one of the reasons why in countries like England, people try their best to not offend you. They try their best to not offend you. They're being polite, not because they want to be necessarily polite, but because they see you as a potential customer. If you offend that person is not coming back as a client to give his money. That's why you see many people in the Middle East sending their kids to study in London, because England has been designed for that. And it is that mindset, that spirit that was transferred in the United States. So in the United States and in England too, but more in the US, it shows you that anybody can be successful. You don't need to have necessarily a PhD to make it in life. That's the American mentality. In France, they focus more on your academic credentials than your actual skills or what you're worth in society. So to me, I knew that if I came in the US, I would have a chance to make it on my own. And England is perhaps the only country in Europe where someone can have access to real economic mobility compared to the rest of Europe. And in the US, everyone has access to economic mobility. That's why you see people leaving whatever they have at home and coming to the US every year. The US is the only country that welcomes more than, I would say, close to 2 million people per year, because people know and they understand the opportunities that they have in this country. That's the Anglo-Saxon mentality. People give you not just the opportunities, but access to the resources for you to create yourself and to bring value to society, something that is not really done in French-speaking countries.
All right, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of any of that. So I'm interested in your perspective because it's unique. The traveling you've done, the cultures you've interacted with, all the writing you've done is unbelievable. And you have like a full-time job. I don't know how you're doing this. Even, you know, I think back to the glory days when I was 31, and even I can't remember having that much vigor at that time. So keep it up. The book we've been discussing is The Economic Condition of Black America in the 20th Century, a Historical and Empirical Analysis. I'm linking to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1931, where you can check that out. And, well, I know I've got you for another 18 episodes if you're up for it over the next the coming months. But I'd love to have you back, and thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much, Amar. I really appreciate it, and I'll be delighted to come back again. And one thing I would like to say before I go,
yes,
is that I think you should have on your show one day Michael Hoffman. He's a great Austrian economist. He has done a lot for the Austrian movement, and I think he really deserves a shot on your show to promote liberty.
Okay, thank you for the tip.
No problem.
All right, we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, that's our episode for today. Tomorrow, our old friend Gene Epstein joins us to talk about the national debt. We hear a lot about the national debt. It gets bigger and bigger. Nothing seems to happen. Does this mean the national debt is harmless? What are the harms of the national debt? Why should we be concerned about it? Gene's going to walk us through all that tomorrow. So make sure you have subscribed to The Tom Woods Show so you don't miss episodes like this. And if you enjoyed this episode, and really, why wouldn't you? Check out supportinglisteners.com, because there you get membership in The Tom Woods Show Elite, which is what in your heart of hearts you know is missing from your life. Best community on earth. Plus, I give you a million and one goodies. So check it out. SupportingListeners.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.